Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Everyone knows who you are.
Good morning, everyone.
Sorry, Dr.
No problem. Can you hear me well? All right, great. It's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me to give a talk. And I apologize for maybe some of you who were at the retreat last Sunday, because I gave a similar talk that I gave last week, but I updated it based on the questions that were asked. So we're going to talk about the cystic fibrosis-related diabetes and its therapies and the use of technology in CFRD. So what is the epidemiology of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes? It is a most common complication of cystic fibrosis. It affects 2% patients in childhood, 20% in adolescent, and about 40 to 50% of the adults. Average age of onset is about 20 years, between 19 and 21 years old. The major risk factors are Delta 508 mutation that is higher risk of diabetes, cystic fibrosis related diabetes, and usually more severe forms of the diabetes. Being female, having hepatobiliary liver disease, and also use of corticosteroids. So the question that I was asked last week, and I first deleted this slide, but I added it back because the question was, what is the difference between type 1 diabetes, cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, and type 2 diabetes? So as you can see that the prevalence is different. So cystic fibrosis-related diabetes is the most prevalent in than other types of diabetes. For type 1 diabetes, it's only 0.2%. For type 2 diabetes, it's going up, but it's about 11% now. But it's 35% in overall in cystic fibrosis. Peak of age is also different. It's as we said, around 20s in CFRD. And it's usually most common in the childhood in type 1, although we're seeing more and more adults diagnosed with type 1. And it's usually in adult onset in for type 2 diabetes, although it's said to see that we're seeing more and more in younger individuals. Usual body habits and body weight, it's normal or underweight in CF, normal in type 1 diabetes, and usually more prevalent in obesity with type 2 diabetes. For insulin deficiency, in CFRD, there is always some basal insulin produced. Whether there is no insulin produced, most of the patients in type 1 diabetes, and actually quite a bit of insulin produced in type 2 diabetes, but it's just insulin resistance and body needs more and more, and pancreas is not able to compensate for this degree of insulin resistance. Hemoglobin A1C. This is a standard measure that we usually use for a, that we usually use for individuals with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which we're not able to use in CFRD because it does not correlate with mean blood sugar levels. And in terms of the complications, microvascular conditions are common in type 1 and type 2. And we're seeing more and more as life expectancy goes up with CF, we are also seeing of those more and more in CFRD. And usually for cause of death in other types of diabetes, it would be the heart disease, but it's more of the lung conditions in CF. So why individuals with CF develop CF-related diabetes? So I'm gonna walk you through this kind of sequence of the events leading to CFRD. So first, it's usually is mutation in cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator protein gene that leads to thick production of the thick secretions that block pancreatic ducts. There is a fatty infiltration and fibrosis of the islet cells that in the pancreas that produce insulin, decrease in the insulin secretion leading to high blood sugars, At the same time, when steroids are given during exacerbations or post-transplant, plus immunosuppressive drugs affecting the insulin production as well, that all leads to insulin resistance, and any infection and any body stress leads to insulin resistance, and all of that leads to hyperglycemia as well, to high blood sugars. So, and again, as we said, the risk factors are Delta 508 mutation, family history of type 2 diabetes, immune response to different bacterial agents or antigens, and as well as decreased glucagon-like peptide, which is produced in the gut. Why do we need to worry about CFRD, and why do we need to try to control it as best as we can? So what kind of impact it has on nutrition and survival? So there's data from Cystic Fibrosis Registry that there is about six-fold greater mortality in individuals who have CFRD compared to the ones who don't. Reduced survival had mainly shown to be more in female than in men, although this difference getting smaller and smaller. If you look, this is the data from 2005, but current data, although we don't have a large data because it just hasn't been enough time since that period of time, but this difference is kind of fading. There is a steady reduction in mortality, as I said, in the past 15 years. And this is due to introduction of new technology, introduction of new insulins comparing to previous data. Decline in weight and body mass index seen usually within the 4 years about prior to diagnosis of CFRD. So body kind of gives the warning that something is coming. And also glucose intolerance can develop. But there are some small studies showing that actually early introduction of insulin therapy can reverse that. Overweight and obesity, as we see more and more, also predispose to more frequently development of CFRD as usual type of diabetes. What is the effect of CFRD on pulmonary function? It had been shown that there is a lower FEV1 in diabetes rather than in non-diabetes in individuals with CF. There is also lower percent of forced vital capacity. There are higher rate of decline of both FEV1 and FVC in even starting with pre-diabetes and lower at baseline and even before diabetes is diagnosed. And you can see at all time points on the graph, non-diabetes had higher forced expiratory volume compared to individuals who had diabetes. High blood sugar affecting the lungs as well. So high blood sugar have been associated with the damage of the lung tissue. It was detected by CT scan. So when they did CAT scan, they showed that bronchiectasis, airway thickening, and damage of actual lung parenchyma is more common in individuals who have CFRD. There is a reduced defense mechanism against infections. And there is a substance that's called airway surface liquid that covers the airway epithelium, and it serves as a protective level for infection to entering the lungs. So this liquid media functions well at low blood sugar levels. So when sugars go high, and they also go as when the blood sugars go high, and then also go higher in this protective layer, and that reduces the defense mechanism and increases the glucose, promotes the pathogen growth in the lungs. So if you can see, there was a study measuring at the Pseudomonas growth in the lungs depending on the blood sugar. So there was a higher growth with the higher blood glucose levels in the airways. So what are the effects of the insulin deficiency and insulin resistance, and are those different? So muscles, we all utilizing the energy when we breathe, when we exercise. So where this energy comes from, it comes from the protein, it comes from the glycogen or glucose storage in the muscle and around the muscle. So the lung muscle, the expiratory and inspiratory muscles, they also use the glucose for the energy. Insulin helps this glucose to enter into the cell. So reduction in inspiratory muscle and the diaphragm strength, which is a muscle as well, have been shown to be present in individuals with CFRD, again, because of the insulin deficiency and less of the glucose ability or lower glucose ability to enter the muscle cells. We usually tell the athletes, for example, type 1 diabetes athlete, that before exercise, you need to fuel yourself. You need to get carbs in, right? So how do we get, so we get carbs in, we need that insulin for that carb to be utilized and for that sugar going into the muscle. So we're insulin deficient, that is difficult to utilize this glucose, and there is a muscle fatigue or muscle weakness. So in cystic fibrosis without diabetes, there is normally increased protein production and protein breakdown just throughout the day. It's kind of at a higher level than in individuals without CF. But because there is increased production and there is increased breakdown, body sort of tried to balance it. And net protein metabolism remains the same. But increased insulin. So when we eat, body produces more insulin, and insulin suppresses the breakdown of protein. So it gives muscle rest and gives the ability to reaccumulate these glucose stores. So what's happening in CFRD? There is a reduced insulin production plus insulin resistance. So it leads to negative protein balance. There are studies showing that if you actually improve nutritional status, plus you reverse of this protein catabolism, then the pulmonary functions can stabilize. So what about the diabetes complications? I mentioned about those previously. So there, usually we worry about two types of complications, microvascular that are affecting small blood vessels, which are in the eyes, kidneys, and nerves. And macrovascular disease, which is primarily the heart disease, the heart vessels. So what has been shown that for microvascular disease, it's the most common complication of both type 1 and type 2. And again, we are seeing it more and more in CF-related diabetes. So we know that retinopathy or eye disease had been found to be in 5 to 27% in individuals with diabetes who had diabetes for anywhere from 3 to 23 years after the diagnosis. Kidney function usually affected approximately 15 years after the diagnosis. And stomach or autonomic neuropathy or gastropathy in approximately 50% of patients, but there are no studies, and it's impossible to say whether that's an effect of transplant, effect of the medication, or effect of the CFRD itself. For the heart disease, for macrovascular complications, hypertension, high blood pressure, high cholesterol seen more frequently in CFRD, but there is no really documented risk of increased risk of heart disease yet. And again, as life expectancy goes up, we probably would be seeing those as well. How do we diagnose and screen CFRD? So for screening, the recommendations are to do annual 75-gram, 2-hour oral glucose tolerance test, starting the age of 10, and again, doing it annually. What are the criteria for the diagnosis? Normal glucose tolerance for fasting blood sugar, less than 126, and 2-hour less than 140. For impaired glucose tolerance, fasting less than 126, and 2-hour blood glucose between 140 and 199. Thank you so much. Great. Okay, great. For impaired fasting, it's between 99 and or 100 or 125. And for diagnosis of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, fasting could be either less than 126 or it could be sometime over 126. But the 2-hour would be 199. But if we're seeing that fasting is already over 126, so we don't no longer need to do the oral glucose tolerance test, we already have the diagnosis of diabetes, CF-related diabetes. Now we have this another term that called INDET, and it stands for indeterminate glycemia. So what is the significance of the INDET? So it's diagnosed when fasting blood sugar is below the criteria for diabetes, and 1 hour is over 200, but 2 hour becomes back to normal, goes back to normal. So it's actually had been shown that it is a future predictor of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, and it is already associated with a worsening of the lung function. And as I mentioned previously, unfortunately, we do not have a very good tool for the diagnosis of CF-related diabetes because A1C is very underestimated, the glycemic control. So it is not recommended for screening, but and because normal A1C does not exclude the diagnosis of CFRD. If it's positive, if it's high, then it is a diagnostic test. But if it's negative, it cannot be ruled out. So we have been using, how else, what are our other tools that we can diagnose CFRD early enough to intervene early, because as I mentioned previously, that it had been shown in several studies that if we intervene early, we can possibly either prevent the declining lung function and prevent the infections. So we now use more and more continuous glucose monitoring device, and we use it in all types of diabetes. And again, as the insurance approval approves, hopefully we'll be using this more and more. So what is this? So that's a little tiny sensor. So it looked big, but it's actually a couple millimeters thin catheter that is flexible platinum catheter that inserted underneath the skin. It's a very thin, pretty much like a hair thin follicle of catheter. It measures the glucose in the interstitial fluid, not in the blood. So glucose from the blood diffuses into the interstitial fluid, and there is a signal from that glucose. So the sensor is protected with the membrane, allowing only glucose molecule to get to the next layer, which is the enzyme. So this enzyme has an ability to convert glucose. It oxidizes the glucose and makes it into the protons that those protons are detected by this little electrode. So this is, if you can barely see the tiny little sensor, this is a kind of a very magnified cross-section of it. So technology is amazing. Although you can imagine that while those all reactions happening, there is a lag time, right? So it takes time for glucose to diffuse to the interstitial fluid. It takes time for the reaction to occur, and it takes time for those signals to go in through this whole mechanism to the little transmitter that analyzes this data. So we do have quite a few different devices now, which has been really good for us and so helpful for the patients. So this one was the first device that's been available back in 1999. It was quite a huge device that patients need to wear on their neck. You can't really take a shower with it unless you put a whole shower bag on your neck and hide this device inside that bag. It was only working for 3 days, and it was blinded for patients. So we could only see it when patients come back and we downloaded, which is still at that time was amazing and impressive. But the science and the technology is moving really fast. So now we have those different devices that have been approved lately. So we have this Guardian 3 sensor that works with the pump, and I'll talk about the pumps later. And this was approved in 2016. It does require calibrations per day, so two calibrations per day. So by entering the blood sugar into the device being taught what that actual electric signal means. So other devices that we have available are Dexcom, and some of you might have seen those. So it is available in several different kind of generations of Dexcom. So Dexcom G4, it's an older version. Some patients are still using it. It's a share, so you can share it with five individuals, your family members or your significant others, or parents love to watch what's happening with the kids when they're at school. G5 is the next generation. It also still requires calibration. It's the Bluetooth enabled. So again, for this device, even the little receiver is no longer needed. You can see everything on your phone or on any smart watch device or smart Fitbit. And again, you can share with five different individuals. The device is worn for 7 days. So you put it in for 7 days and then exchange it, or sometimes not exchange it and continue using it. But again, FDA approved just for 7 days of use. The newer device is the Dexcom G6. It's already approved for 10 days, and it's just been approved last year. It's a factory calibrated, so no longer calibration is no longer needed, which is amazing. And in type 1 individuals and some of the CF individuals who have been wearing this device, and you can wear it for 10 days without calibration, had been really amazed, and they said that their fingers, for the first time, that's getting healed and the callus is getting softer because you'll no longer have to calibrate. And some patients who are wearing it, they would say, oh gosh, I haven't checked my blood sugar for 3 months. I can't believe I didn't have to poke myself. The accuracy is pretty good. So we usually use this term that's called MARD, and it stands for mean absolute relative difference, which means that what is the percentage of the actual blood sugar points of the meter that shows that is away from what the value is of the reference range. So this low number, 9%, had been used for the reference range in the studies when actually lab devices had been used. When you use it with your meter for calibration, it's totally different because, if anything, your meters are about 15 to 20% of the MARD. So if you think about this device, maybe a little more accurate, but because it has a delay time again, and if blood sugars are changing rapidly, this is why we still recommend, if the blood sugar changing rapidly, check your blood sugar. But if not, you can trust the device, and if FDA approved, to be used as an actually device to dose the insulin with based on this blood sugar. Now we can use it in Medicare patients, which had been really wonderful since 2016. And again, it replaces finger sticks, so it approved for the non-adjunct use, meaning that you can trust the device and you can dose the insulin based on the data from this device. And calibration is needed for G5. Medicare did approve the G6, but the company, it's such a huge demand, so the company is behind with supplying this demand, so therefore they have not released it for Medicare patients yet. For CF, GHPP, CCS had been kind of generous, and they had been approving the CGMs as well. So Medi-Cal, just straight Medi-Cal, unfortunately not yet. Other device that had been used a lot, it's a Libre, Freestyle Libre, made by Abbott. It is a standard CGM that used, it's a lot used in Europe. It's first had been approved in Europe. It's approved now in the US for 14-day use. So this device does not provide alerts and alarms for if you go low or high, as Dexcom does. But you can use this little reader that just scans the blood sugar with wearing this little circle on your arm. And you can see it looks simple on the arm, but you can see how complicated it is on when you open it up. You can scan your blood sugars as often as every 5 minutes, and you can get up to 288 readings per day. And again, everyone tests differently. I usually encourage patients to do it at least 8 to 10 times a day. As long as if you wear it, just use it. It does not reduce the duration of the use of the life of the sensor. So it's been really helpful. So the new version is coming probably in October, November. That will also be available with alerts and alarms. Another CGM that we haven't used that for that much because of the, just again, calibrations involved and the accuracy a little lower, but it's a Guardian Connect CGM. It's with Medtronic, again, this little Medtronic Guardian sensor, and it all goes through the phone. It has this app, which is called Sugar IQ, and it analyzes your data, and it kind of gives you warning, you have been high after breakfast for the past 3 days. You may want to look at your carb ratio for breakfast and things like that. So it doesn't give you specific dose recommendations, but it sort of warns you about what's not going. Or you've been low for the past week in the middle of the night. You may want to adjust either your basal rates or your basal insulin. So the newer device that we have, and actually, to my surprise, it's been used more and more, and patients love it, although I did not, again, to my surprise, because it's an implantable sensor. It's a little sensor, this tiny thing that's inserted underneath the skin in the arm, in between the two muscles, deltoid and the tricep muscle. It stays in the body for 3 months. You don't need to charge it. You don't need to do anything with it. But you do need to wear a little transmitter outside on the arm. And this transmitter sends the light signal, and that's how it activates the sensor. So it still does require 2 calibrations per day. Again, it's a 90-day use. So for 3 months, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to, again, insert it as you have to do with Dexcom and Libre. The sensor is, again, charged by the transmitter. Transmitter charged daily, but it's only about 5 to 10 minutes charging. It is so far the most accurate sensor on the market, a little bit more accurate than others. And the best thing about this sensor, that for someone who does not feel highs and lows, and let's say if you're going swimming and you can't take your Dexcom with you, so you don't know what your blood sugars are if you do your swimming or you're doing your aerobic exercise in the pool. For this one, the transmitter actually vibrates on you. Different gives you different buzz if you go high or low. You don't need to, if you travel, you don't need to carry a lot of supplies with you, just that little transmitter and just with that one charger. So again, in the U.S., so far it's approved for 90 days. In Europe, it is approved for 6 months, for 180 days. So hopefully that longer-term approval is coming over here too in the next maybe 3 to 6 months or so. But again, it's a little surgical procedure to insert it. You do a little cut with the scalpel and put that in. It depends how you respond to the, or how you heal. Some patients you can't even see, they come back in 3 months and you can't even see where the scar was. Some patients do have a little scar. But again, despite all of this procedure involved and needed to come to the office, I've inserted 10 so far. And you have to get certified for the insertion. And 8 out of 10 patients want to come back. They love it and they don't want to use any other sensors. All right, so how do we use this technology, specifically NCF, and what is the data? So continuous glucose monitoring device can actually detect early abnormalities in glucose handling of the body. It has been validated in 102 children and adolescents with CF and considered to be a reliable tool and accurate tool. 1/3 of the individuals with normal oral glucose tolerance test in the study were found to have glucose abnormalities detected by CGM, but not detected on any other tests. And you can see on this graph that the blood sugars could be normal, but you can see those spikes that actually are seen on CGM and close to, again, 180 is the red line, which is had been shown to have some association with increased infections and declining lung function, but we're not able to detect that so early with other tests. There are only case reports so far in a very small case series of the use of CGM in CFRD. It possibly predict the pulmonary exacerbations? And that's what was addressed in the paper in Journal of Cystic Fibrosis just in 2017. So CF patients with impaired glucose tolerance were wearing the Dexcom G4, again, the first generation of Dexcom, and they were unmasked for 3 months, and you can see that the blood glucose levels at all time points were higher before, even for 3 months before individuals had an CF exacerbation. So we usually say in the clinic that if you see unexplained blood sugars going high, then expect something to be coming. It could be viral infection, it could be, if it's post-transplant, it could be some kind of either mild rejection or some kind of infection or something else is coming. So why do we need to worry about blood sugars to be tightly controlled in CF? So in general, in any type of diabetes, it had been shown that tight control can lead to reduction of eye disease by 65%, kidney disease by 54%, 54%, and nerve involvement by 60%. Risk of any cardiovascular disease event, heart attacks or stroke, reduced by 42%. Non-fatal myocardial infarction, stroke, or death from cardiovascular disease were reduced in the type 1 studies by 57%. So what is the data of CFRD reduction or control in cystic fibrosis individual? Again, as we mentioned, that pulmonary function begins to decline several years before CFRD diagnosis. It's already started in pre-diabetes period. Rate of decline directly related to the severity of the deficiency of the insulin. And insulin insufficiency compromises also nutritional status by creating this catabolic state that we talked about before. So it's with the breakdown of protein and fat. The study in diabetes care in 2009 was a multi-center randomized placebo-controlled trial that showed that insulin therapy, if initiated early, can reverse weight loss and nutritional deficits in cystic fibrosis-related diabetes in both who have fasting hyperglycemia and fasting normal glycemia, so normal fasting blood sugars or elevated fasting blood sugars. Various studies showed that even blood glucose of over 144 shows in the airways of elevated blood sugar and promoted response of the epithelium with the decreased of the kind of barrier for the respiratory pathogens. Hyperglycemia had been shown that it has an increased risk for any oxidative stress and some other studies that I did not mention here. So for all of the studies, the conclusion was that higher blood sugars promotes pro-inflammatory and pro-bacteria environment in the airways. And there was no difference of two sort of type of CF that we distinguish, the one with high fasting blood sugar and the one with the normal blood sugar, but elevated blood sugars during the day. So for both types of diabetes. We do try to introduce tight control, but low blood sugar or hypoglycemia is a huge limitation because the tighter we get to the target control, the highest the rate of the low blood sugar. So what is the impact of low blood sugar specifically in CFRD? There a study that looked at the patterns, impact of low blood sugar, high blood sugar, and glucose variability for looking at inpatients who were treated with insulin CF-related diabetes. This is, you can see that this is the survival analysis to death over 3.5 years follow-up period. Red line is hypoglycemia admission. So hypoglycemia is associated with increased or lower survival rate, which is, that's why it was a concern, and that's why with the use of the technology, we're hoping to reduce that hypoglycemia and being able to maintain tight control without lowering risk of low blood sugar. So now we're moving to another devices that we use a lot, and we're using more and more in CF-related diabetes, which is the insulin pumps. Obviously, if we only would have had this pump, no one would wear it. So this is the first pump, I think. The weight of it was anywhere from 30 to 40 pounds or something like that. So it was in 1963. It gave the insulin straight into the vein, but because you give insulin intravenously, obviously blood sugar control is really good and easier to control because it's fast acting. Later on, Various other devices had been introduced. This device had a large syringe outside the pump that needed only diluted, only was able to handle diluted insulin because the rate of insulin delivery was couldn't be very slow, and it couldn't deliver micromilliliters. So that's why insulin had to be diluted. And you can see comparing to that the current size of the pump now. So what is the pump and how it works? The little catheter is inserted underneath the skin. It's a plastic catheter, or it could be a very short needle, and it delivers insulin as subcutaneous tissue. Only one type of insulin needed. There is no need for long-acting insulin anymore. So the short-acting insulin is delivered 24/7 by microboluses delivered every 3 to 5 minutes. And when individual is eating, the pump is programmed for what is the insulin to carb ratio, what is the correction factors, meaning how much one unit glucose, or how much one unit of insulin will lower the blood glucose by, and what is the target blood sugar, and what is the duration of the insulin action. So those are the current pumps available. As you see, they're very different from the first one that I showed you, and they are very cool, tiny little gadgets that are worn at different places. This is the Medtronic pump. This is the older Medtronic pump. This is the Tandem, all touch screen. You can see this. Miss Idaho was wearing this pump. It's a very popular pump now. It's rechargeable, does not need the batteries. All other pumps need the batteries so far. This is the tubeless pump. It's called Omnipod or Insulet. It's worn on the arms. Or abdomen, or buttock, or your thigh, anywhere you want to wear it. It's a pod that has 200 units of insulin in it. It's great for someone who does not like the needle sticks because you never actually see the needle. You tape this pod to the body, you push the button on PDM, and then you hear a click that is sort of distracting click. The needle gets inside from the pod, so you never see it. It's all underneath the pod, underneath the tape. Patients like it because of the freedom. You don't have to, it's not connected to the tubing, to the pump. As you can see, those little kids wear those pumps. I usually go to diabetes camps. I volunteer as a medical staff for type 1 diabetes, and a lot of kids wear those pumps, and they love it because they can do all their activities. They're not tied to the tubing. Although, as you can see, it does stick a little bit, and someone who really like fancy and tight fit clothes, that may show up. So we're trying to work on creating the artificial pancreas to have as little individual involvement or patient involvement as possible, and where we are at this point. So this is the roadmap where we are trying to go. So the first one with the artificial pancreas is trying to create the suspend that the pump, when I showed you this delivery of the basal insulin for 24/7. If sensor that is integrated with the pump, its sensor feels that the blood sugar is going to be at a critically low level within 30 minutes, the pump will stop insulin delivery. So we're already past this point. Hypoglycemia minimizer, that's sort of similar, but it predicts a low blood sugar and stops the blood sugar if it's only predicted to be low, not when it's already get to the low. So if it's predicted to be less than 70, 80, depending on what we set it up for, within 30 minutes, the pump will already shut off, and then it will restart when the blood sugar starts going up. Those are all kind of in the horizon, and where we are now, it's at this level that we have now commercially available automated hybrid loop closed insulin pump that I'll show you here. So what are the components of this pump? So it's a CGM, it's a sensor, it's a receiver, which is usually the pump itself. It's a little algorithm that analyzes the data and sends it back to the insulin pump to provide the action of how much insulin to deliver. So if you're sleeping at night, your blood sugar going up or down, so the pump is sort of working on the background on adjusting the basal insulin depending on where the blood sugars are going. Why is it taking, unfortunately, such a long time for people to create it? Because there are major obstacles on the way. So one big obstacle is a delay time. So the insulin does take time. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes sometimes to get absorbed from the skin. A glucose sensor, as we talked about, takes time to measure this glucose, transfer it to the signal. The controller takes time to analyze it, sends it back to the pump. Now, while all of this is happening, liver keeps producing extra glucose because for this insulin to actually reach the liver, it takes 90 to 100 minutes comparing to the, if pancreas normally produces insulin, it will take a couple of minutes because it sends it straight through the portal circulation straight to the liver when insulin is produced. So all of that are major obstacles to produce, to create this closed loop system. So this is how it works. You can see little pink bars. So this is the pump, how it's working in the background. So you can see that the night patient is sleeping and the insulin being delivered, and then smaller bars and higher bars depending on where the blood sugars are going. You can see that this patient clearly is not shy of giving himself eating carbs, so eating quite frequent meals, which we're expecting usually from CF as well. That's why I chose that particular patient. But as you can see on this graph, so this peach graph is before patients started using the artificial pancreas or closed loop. And you can see how much blood sugars are better after he started using it. And you can see also the green bar reflecting what is the percent of time spent in target wearing this pump comparing to, it's almost double comparing to without using the device. So it's not a perfect device. It's not something that would completely replace user interference, but unfortunately, that's what ideally we want to, but it's way better than anything that we so far have on the market. A few of those devices that we have, again, commercially available. As one of our pediatric colleagues usually say about this, those pumps now, that this is not your iPhone 10, this is your little flip phone. It does work, but it's way better than your stationary phone, but it's not your iPhone 10 yet. So we're working on this artificial pancreas. What about minimizing low blood sugars, adding some glucagon to the pump? The first studies have been done with this much devices being worn, obviously not fun, as you can see. You can't really do too many physical activities, although patients did, surprisingly. They did their bike rides for miles and miles, and somehow they were able to tuck it all in and do it, whatever they needed to do. But this little, those two little pumps, the tandem pumps, one had insulin, one had glucagon in it, and the iPhone, which was used as a algorithm device, sent the signals to either glucagon pump or the insulin pump to deliver little boluses. Now, the studies are moving to a single device. If you look at the online, there is a device called iLet. It's still bigger than the usual pump, but it is going to be used for, hopefully at some point, for this bi-hormonal closed-loop system. We do have a new insulin pen that is smart pen that I like a lot. Some patients like it, some patients don't like it for the extra work. But it's actually pens with a little Bluetooth. So the benefit of it that it's connected to your phone, and this little Bluetooth beams to the phone app how much insulin was delivered, and the app shows you what time did you give yourself insulin and how much active insulin is still there. So I think it's great because, as you all know, there's so much stuff in our mind and we're so busy and distracted so easily, right, always. Sometimes you would take a shot or take a pill and then in 2 minutes you'll think, did I really do it or not? So it disappeared from the table, but I don't remember actually taking it. So that's the same thing with the insulin, and you are afraid to give yourself insulin twice, or so you ended up not giving yourself insulin, and if you actually missed it, then your blood sugar go high. So the benefit of this one is that you can see it on the app to see if the insulin was delivered. So what do we know about use of technology in CFRD? So there are factors contributing to more difficult control of diabetes than even in non-CF. So it's exocrine insufficiency or pancreatic insufficiency requiring pancreatic enzyme, variability in the food absorption, gastroparesis, and all the chronic infection, use of steroids. The calculated insulin, the calculated nutritional requirements are way higher in CFRD than in non-cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. And you can see an average for CFRD required 120 to 150% of the calories needed comparing to other types of diabetes. And that includes all the nutrients and carbohydrates in particular. So what are the benefits of insulin pump? It's able to give insulin boluses before each meal. You don't have to take a shot. You just need to press the button. You can take snacks more easily with each meal. Sometimes patients who are really diligent about their insulin injections would say, oh, do I really want this snack? Because now I have to go and get my insulin and take a shot. So here you don't have to do it. You just press the button and the insulin gets delivered. The benefit also of the snacking and taking insulin via the pump or smart or pen that they calculate active insulin remaining. So it prevents the insulin stacking and subsequent low blood sugars. So it's more convenient to use. And the data from the adolescent and young adult studies with CFRD showed that unfortunately, patients do wear the pump, but they tend to discontinue the pump use, and the highest discontinuation rate was in CFRD compared to type 1 or type 2 diabetes. What are the possible explanations to that? Rapidly changing insulin requirements, decrease requirements of the insulin during the kind of low period, low insulin in between exacerbations, and feels like I'm doing well, why do I need that hassle to wear this pump? Different CF therapies, there are just a lot of other things that needed to be done, and it just adds to the burden of the disease. It's safe to use. There are no severe hypoglycemia documented in CFRD, and the largest study, again, was in 21 patients, so we don't have long studies and long-term studies in CFRD. So use of continuous glucose monitoring device had identified patients who are at risk for CFRD. We talked about that it can identify individuals who are at high risk for exacerbations, but also hires the ones who have an actual risk for developed CFRD. Although OGTT is a standard test, the data from 2014 shows that the annual oral glucose tolerance test done in less than a third of the patients with CFRD in adults. So there was a study looking at prediction of CFRD of the future, of prediction of the health outcomes in someone who can use the CGM or someone who uses CGM. Patients getting simultaneous oral glucose tolerance test and compared with 3 days of CGM. And it did show that a CGM was very consistent with a 1 hour post meal blood test on the OGTT. So again, as we said, the INDAT determines the glycemic control earlier than we actually get diagnosed with CFRD, looking at the 2 hour glucose. So as you can see that the patients who who had the CGM on, who had this indeterminate glycemia had developed diabetes always sooner than the ones who did not have it. An abnormal CGM blood sugar of over 200 on two subsequent days of wearing CGM identified those who developed cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. And sensitivity and specificity of the test was really good. So the last thing that I want to talk to you about is again, as I said, we wanted to try to reduce the burden as much as possible. So we're trying to work on beta cell transplant, islet cell transplant. And the idea is if we're doing the lung transplant, why can't we transplant beta cells at the same time and reduce this burden of the disease and reduce the insulin requirements or eliminate the need of the insulin after the transplant, especially the time period when there are all the medications added that make the blood sugars more difficult to control. So there are no studies specifically on CFRD, but there is one study, one case report basically that was done in a child who is 14-year-old with cystic fibrosis. He was diagnosed with CF at the age of 14 months old. He was diagnosed with CFRD at 11 years old, and he developed also liver and liver disease and multiple resistant infections with multiple admissions to the hospital, and overall his health was significantly declining. So he underwent both lung transplant and the beta cell transplant, and you can see his insulin requirements. So the blue bar is the stimulated C-peptide, which is a reflection of the insulin function. So you can see how it actually goes up after the transplant. And the green line insulin shows insulin requirements before transplant and how they're declining after transplant. So this is, again, this is a hope that eventually that maybe will become a standard procedure. At Stanford, we are working on getting funding on beta cell transplant, and we're trying to target as CF with lung transplant as one of the categories in the patient population that we're going to do. But again, it's still in the process. We've been working on it for, I would say, at least over a year, meeting weekly, discussing the plan, discussing the data. We're presenting that to the hospital, hopefully in the next few weeks, to be able to get funding and hopefully start doing it in the near future. Now, diabetes is not easy. And when you add that on top of the CF, on top of the, all the breathing treatments, it's, again, it adds the complexity, it adds the burden. We have, even just without CF, we have such a term as diabetes burnout. And it's a kind of normal feeling that people get, and a lot of people will have it. It's just hard to disclose it to others, and you feel like you want to hide it. But you don't need to hide it. You can show it to others. That's absolutely normal. That's physiologic to develop it. It's the definition that it's a collection of feelings and behaviors that occur taking aftercare after the diabetes over and over again for 24/7. And again, we have hope for future. All the technology and innovations are moving fast, so hopefully in the next decade or so, we'll have way better ways of treating it. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions if there is time. Also, I really apologize. I won't be able to stay for the panel discussion because of the family circumstances, but I'm happy. I told Siri to share my email, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I'm not able to answer them today.
Hi, thanks for a really wonderful talk. That was great. My question is, what do you do with an abnormal one-hour glucose tolerance test in your practice now? Because the data strongly suggests that intervention at that point is indicated. What's your practice?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So what I usually do is, one is to try to work with a dietitian and try to get the dietary advice for the patient that the meals would be less, sort of containing less of the simple carbs, but more of the complex carbs and more of the higher nutritional value carbs with a combination of some healthy fat and protein. So what's the first impairment that happens in CFRD and other types of diabetes is this first phase of the insulin release. So as soon as we swallow the food, within a few minutes, our pancreas produces the surge of the insulin, and then it kind of trickles slowly over the period of time as the food's getting absorbed. So that first phase is impaired in all the diabetes, and specifically CFRD even more because of those thick secretions promote the inflammation in the beta cells in the islets. So if you kind of try to minimize that first phase response, try to do it really slowly, with, again, eating some start meal with the protein, start meal with nuts and cheese rather than if you can't eat it, or some protein or a protein shake rather than the rice and potatoes. So that's sort of the principle. That's one thing. Other thing that I usually try to encourage patients to have a meter and to test. And if you, after larger meals, and to test 1 hour or 2 hours after larger meals. Again, if it's a complex meal or complex carbs, then I would usually suggest even 2 hours because it takes longer for that glucose to peak. And if you see consistently values over certain numbers, usually over under 60, 160, 180, then we may need to initiate very small dose of prandial insulin, mealtime insulin.
Thank you for a great presentation. I heard her speak and give basically this in 2018. The Freestyle Libre kind of changed my daughter's life. Never knew she was having real lows at night. But my question is about CFTR modulators. Since my daughter's been on Symdeko, she was really starting to crash at night. And so then it was like a take out the Lantus. And then she now even crashes with her normal dosing. So are you seeing correlations with your patients who are on CFTR modulators and changes in their blood sugar?
Yeah, so it's a great question because this is, there are no good studies looking at how CF modulators would affect the glucose control. But we are definitely seeing significant reduction of the insulin requirements. And again, if you modulate the actual kind of physiology or pathophysiology of the disease that and improve all the CF comorbidities, that as you improve the insulin production as well. So if you reduce those thick secretions, and so again, we're seeing this more in individuals who have fairly good residual function of the pancreas, because the lower the function of the pancreas, the less of the ability to sort of recover that function exists. But yes, we are seeing this definitely. So that's another hope. So with those medications that hopefully the diabetes will be less and less common.
Hello, Dr. Messina. Thank you so much for coming twice in 1 week. One's at retreat and one's here. It's wonderful to hear you again and to see the information you provided. So I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We talked briefly, and I just wanted to open this up for this community, about having more of a low-carb diet, particularly if it's really hard to control sugars. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. And also, I know this is a second question, but does using... And it might be a silly question, but I have a terrible sweet tooth. And if some of you saw my dad eating last night, you might know it might be genetic. But it's also, could using insulin make a craving for sugar? Mm-hmm. Not when you're just hypo, but just generally speaking, does using insulin make you, or is it just an addiction?
I don't think it's an addiction, and just to make your kind of feel better is that it's a lot of individuals would say the same thing. Type 1 diabetes patients would say the same thing. Before they got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, they would say, oh, I never crave for sweets, but now I can eat any sweets I see, and I really like dream about the sweets. So it's very common. So really, we talked about that insulin is an anabolic hormone, right? So it stimulates kind of all the production. So when you use up your glucose, your proteins faster, you kind of want to replenish, body wants to replenish it more. So maybe that's the possible explanation to that. Insulin does not penetrate to the brain structures that are affecting the appetite. So it shouldn't be affecting it this way, but a lot of people would say the same thing. In regards to low-carb diets, so the two kind of populations that cannot be on the low-carb diet, in my view, and have been shown in the studies, though, would be pregnancy and CF-related diabetes. It's a similar analogy to pregnancy. So pregnancy, we're saying baby is your second brain. It needs the glucose at all the time points. So the same thing for CF-related diabetes, as we said, that the breaking down the protein and fat and utilization of glucose is way faster than in individuals without diabetes. Therefore, by eating low-carb diet, you're decreasing those storage of the glucose that you can kind of barely accumulate because the things happen so fast in the body. Therefore, if you exercise, you break down the protein and fat around the muscles really quickly. So you go into this catabolism way faster than the individual without cystic fibrosis. Therefore, in accumulating acidic environment or lactic acid around the muscle will reduce the exercise performance, will cause more of the muscle weakness, will promote weight loss, which again, for the majority of the patients with CF, we do not want. Although there is a subset of CF patients now, and I mentioned it last week, that I see some of the patients who are actually diagnosed with CFRD late, diagnosed in the their 40s and 50s. When they already had been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes first and then presented with multiple sinus infections and were actually tested for a gene and were positive. So those patients, sure, those patients would need diet and exercise and they get like a regular treatment as just regular type 2 diabetes. Plus, they don't need significant amount of carbohydrates because their mechanism of diabetes is more of the insulin resistance rather than insulin deficiency. But if you were diagnosed younger in life, still insulin deficiency predominates, and therefore insulin is needed. And if you need more insulin that helps the muscle to utilize this glucose and not break down the proteins and fat, the carbs are needed. Saying that, I always tell my CF patients that carbs are good carbs. I'm not talking about a gallon of juice or a box of cereal. It should be smart carbs. Use them wisely, and there should be over 100-120% at least carbs than in the normal individuals, but use the grains, use the complex carbs, use the more nutritional carbohydrates rather than just the simple carbs. And obviously candies sometimes are okay, but again, use them wisely. Use chocolate-covered almonds, so you get protein, you get your healthy fat.